This is Nicola Stiliani speaking, and this is an interview that is being conducted at the Carmel III Memorial Museum in Surawi in Botswana. And can you say your name?
My name is Skobi Lukutile, curator at Carmel III Memorial Museum.
And you're happy for me to record this interview?
I'm okay with you recording this interview.
Thank you. Can you just start by telling me a bit about yourself?
A bit about myself. I am from this village. I was born in this village. I did most of my education, starting primary and secondary education. And after completing my secondary education, really not even completing because I went halfway to what is known as junior certificate. I didn't do the Cambridge certificate or Form 5. Then I can be termed a dropout because I didn't complete the whole thing. I found a way of continuing to learn outside school, different ways, informally informing me different topics. And then the blessing was that I also made friends with a lot of volunteers who came to our village, Surawi, either through Peace Corps or any other volunteer organization. There were numerous, some from Holland, Peace Corps in America. There was a ONB, Organization of the Netherlands, something volunteer, that's with the Dutch. There was CUSO for Canada and many others. And England had many too. There was one which I think didn't pay a lot of money because the guys who worked for that, you could see they had a limited budget. This was the IVS, International Volunteer Service, I think. I don't think it's still there. Back in the days, there was something called that. Yeah, my interaction with all these visitors or helpers or developers who came to Surawi helped me to continue learning outside school. And I informed myself in different areas. And also the kind of things that they wanted to know about our culture and our village and our area or Botswana as a whole. Sometimes people will ask questions and I have no answer. So this got me to try and learn more about us. And of course, there's no school. Even today, I don't think you'll find a school where you can learn the subject fully well. So I used all kind of methods, talk to elderly people, check what is available and what is written. And so slowly the interest of learning about my culture grew. And then many years later when the museum started, I was interested in finding how I can help, how I can be of help. And I remember passing by and talking to the founding curator was from Denmark, Maria Rita was her name, and asking me, what is happening here, how can one help? And then I was told that they'll be putting up the first exhibition, which was Botswana Basket, a collection of baskets from the Okavango. I think they covered all the walls in this room from that end here and that side. Then I came and joined them, assisted in putting up the exhibition, and then next thing they were, okay, this exhibition is going to be open to public. And suddenly they realized that they didn't have enough people to look after the exhibition during the opening hours. So automatically there was a vacancy for me, a job offer, and I joined the museum and starting as an all man, really, doing almost everything that needs to be done here and there. And 2 years before joining the museum, I assisted a German scholar who was studying Basara, Bushmen, or I don't know what people call them today. But there is this ethnic group that people have been, yeah, giving names to. I've also had the term Sen used to describe them, and I don't know which one is correct. So this German professor was collecting data for comparative studies of, you know, different Sara or Sen dialects, and I went out with him. We did a large part of Botswana, like starting from here and extending to Maung, passing Maung to the Kalahadi, and then some parts of the Okavango as well. We went into the delta and collected. We had a word list and we were asking, like, what do you call this in your language? And this guy knew how to write in the signs and all that. So again, I was, whether I liked it or not, I got informed more about the Basaro language, its structure, and how I can compare it with the... Suddenly I knew how to, like, look at this language and compare it to Setswana and other languages and see which one, like if I'm looking at Setswana or English, which one is closer to Sen or Sesarwa in grammatically, like if you're looking at how, you know. And of course the language will also include a bit of culture, because there were some cultural practices that were, you know, unique to these groups, and they had like terms describing, you know, certain things. So I picked my Sen vocabulary increased, and and it also helped, like when I started working here at the museum and I had this background, now I knew how to ask questions without like leading, even though I know what kind of answer I want. I knew how to ask and wait for the answer to come, you know, without and it was through this exercise of working with this German scholar.
How did you come to be working with him?
Yeah, that's another interesting. There was somebody who knew that there was this Botswana guy who has done JC, junior certificate, and he was just loitering and not doing anything. Remember one afternoon, I was at home, and this guy approached me. I think the German scholar knew Ruth Vorkammer, who was teaching some ladies typing, and then he told Ruth that he was having problems with the guy who was the current assistant, you know, field assistant he was working with. And then Ruth told the ladies there, and one of the girls went and told a man called, what was his name? He was commonly called Mr. Brown. And at that time, Mr. Brown was assisting another scholar. So Mr. Brown and what's his name? The German scholar, Rainer Bossen, came to my place one afternoon. I was just like laying there in bed, not minding my business. And I had like footsteps and people could hear that someone was like they sounded like a little strange in their tongue. And then as I stepped outside, there were these two gentlemen. One regular brother that I know from Sorua, and then this stranger with their blue eyes. And the story was that, oh, since you are not occupied with anything, do you mind assisting this man to do ABC around here? I said, oh, well and good. And they also offered to pay us, oh, double payment. I'll get information and money. So that's how I started with this guy. But then after working with him for like a week or so, he was like, I think I've gotten, I like the way you work and I'm so used to working with you. Because the agreement was that I'll assist him only in Serua, and when he leaves to carry on the greater trip, this other guy will take over. So now the guy said, I would like you to continue, because it would be crazy. I have to retrain, you know, like train a new person, and, you know, so, but I'm not interested in that. So After a week we went, now it was me and the German guy now going to this guy's home some afternoon, lazy afternoon, and finding him at home, and we broke the sad news that he no longer had the job. Yeah, he felt like that. So, yeah, and of course the guy who offered the job wanted that, and we couldn't argue against it. So I ended up being the lucky one who continued with the German scholar, and we like did an extensive travel within Botswana, covering all areas where you can find Basaro. And then, like I was saying, I got to know that there were different ethnic groupings and how they relate. And there were some groups that were like distinct, you know, so far apart, like German and Chinese or something like that. All this came clear to me when I was doing this field work. That's why when coming to the museum, I was really, it was like God's plan to prepare me to come and take up this job, because this guy had done it before, and he has been to different parts of Africa studying. He was a linguist studying languages and all that, and he had all the stories, and he knew how to go about, you know, conducting, getting information as in like in line with what human science is, in lack of a better word. So I got some training in there, and I think again that's what made it easier for me to land a job here, was when I assisted the founding curator, and she found that I knew a bit about this and that and how to phrase questions, and you know, when we were collecting items for the museum or asking information from people, say we are accessioning some item into the collection, and then she was kind of impressed, and I stayed on since up until today.
Can you tell me more about the kind of the founding of the museum and its very early days? And also, you said in this room, and we're in the office.
Mm-hmm. This is where the space or the building that we today call the office, the main admin block. This is what we started with, because when we started, the main building of the museum was in a bad shape. It couldn't be used for exhibitions and stuff. So, and it had to be restored. So everything had to happen here. This was before we added these two walls, this wall and that wall. So it was like an open exhibition area. And I think I mentioned this in Sussex. Like, this was an exciting moment for us, in that we could not have one exhibition for an extended period, because people would get tired of seeing the same thing over and over. So our exhibits changed, and if you have changing exhibitions, it's like people come and they expect to see something different or something new, you know. So I think that made us a bit more tasty and better than other museums. The story of the museum, or the idea, people have had this idea of having a museum in Sorowa many, many years, like maybe in the 70s or even earlier than that. Somebody will, you know, come up with this and start something. And then mostly it was volunteers, people coming from outside Botswana. And then when their time is over, they'll go back to their countries and leave whatever they had started there. And then maybe 2 or 3 years, or maybe five even, someone comes and they, you know, stumble on this file. They say, oh, it's interesting. They take it up. And so we have had this up and down thing, this kind of hiccup thing with the development of this museum. And then people like Khalima Motsete were also mentioned in the history of like starting a museum in Soro. This was like citing all the events and stories that surround us in Soro, like the flogging, the famous flogging of the white men, and the marriage, the signing of the mining treaty, and yeah, so many things happen here. But it was not until in the 80s when really the road towards having the museum in Sorue, having a museum in Sorue was like now fully paid. Because Lapetso Khamasan donated this whole property, belonged to his father, and he said, okay, you want to start a museum, you can do it here. And then there was a man who was a biologist and interested in insects, who was also going to be part of this. He was from Denmark, and he would sit at some of the meetings with the interim committee. And being from Denmark, he connected with his home country, seeking a qualified curator or museum person to come and help with move things here. And then Maria Rita was seconded, she came, and then suddenly things were moving the right way. Now the crazy thing is that Maria Rita and this entomologist, or the entomologist and many other people, he couldn't get along with a number of people. I think he understood insects more than people, or the other way. So they had some kind of fallout, and he pulled out and he said, I'm not going to be a part of this. And he continued working with his researching insect at the Silver Farmers Brigade. The collection of insect was later, as the agreement stood, was later donated or deposited at the National Museum. They have a natural history corner. That's where I think the insects are. And then the lady stayed on and started the museum and worked with. Back then, Alec Campbell was still with the National Museum, and he helped, with ideas and how to go about this and that. And also giving support, because the National Museum was already established. So even the basket exhibition I was talking about was actually something that traveled from, previously shown from at the National Museum, and it traveled to Sorowe, Francistown, because Supangwa was already starting, and I don't think it went to Mau, but it did that tour.
So it wasn't specifically about things from here then, it was about the whole
country? Yeah, because it was like I called it Botswana basket, yeah. It was from the Okobamu, yeah.
Because now the emphasis in the museum is very much the history of Sorowe.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Good that you brought that up, because we are said to be more of a regional museum covering central district. I don't know if we are capacious enough to do that, but that was the idea. Okay. And so we will try to, in terms of exhibitions and what we are talking about, it should be from the central district. Even if it's from other parts of Botswana, then it should be how does it connect with our area?
Mm. And when was the main the building that's now the museum displays? When was that? When did they finish renovating that and start making the?
I think it was the restoration of the Red House was completed in 1989, if I'm not mistaken. Or was it 1988? Because I remember shortly after opening the main building of the museum, the Red House, I went to Denmark, and that was around 1989, because I came back in 1990. Yeah. So somewhere there.
No, tell me about Denmark.
The reason I went to Denmark again was to try and learn more about museums, because here, otherwise it would have been just the National Museum. They were the only ones with an extended history. But before that, I had been to Nyuma in Zambia, at that Barotse Land Museum. They had opened a few years, they were in operation a few years earlier than us. So I went there to go and see how they were doing things and came back. And then, of course, there was Denmark. I found that museums in Denmark were fully developed, and they had a very, very, very rich and overwhelming culture. It was so much. And again, people would be willing to give things to the museum or sometimes it was a question of space and storage. I remember at the museum in SP, I went to the storeroom because I was learning how to catalog museums. Man, it was a huge collection stored. And I was asking, like, what are you going to be doing with this? Some of the things were really, they had to try and be nice and accept some things, you know. You come to this shelf, you find 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe even 12, I don't know how many. I tried to count, I can't remember the numbers. All pianos, violins, and you name it. But even though they had all these, people were still like interested in keeping it proper and talking more about it, and you know. Even people who are not like working in museums, they will know that they have some connection with the Vikings. They, you know, our country was once covered with ice, which I found very, very interesting, because here it would be people who had like looked at history or who had been informed in some way who have that kind of knowledge. But in Denmark, I found that it was a common knowledge, the explanation of like, you know, how flat it is, and you know, sometimes in what is this place called? Silkable. They have like these little humps which they call hills, because Denmark is flat. they call those hills and those little things. And people knew how this happened. Like I'm talking like ordinary people, you know. Yeah, no, when the ice melted after the ice age, this is what happened, and that's how we ended up with this. And so, like, okay, they seem to be interested in their history, their culture, and all that. Yeah, and that was another thing, the pride that the Danes displayed in their, you know, starting from the old ways, you know, the wooden clocks. They'll tell you why the wooden clocks, and then come into what they are eating today, you know, like what is Danish and how we do it the Danish way, you know. And they would never get tired of explaining, in Denmark, this is how we do it. The Danish this, the Danish that. And I was like, yeah, maybe one day we'll be like that. You know, we will learn more about our culture and take pride in talking about it and, you know, sharing it with people. Like I was saying, because we couldn't send many people, we didn't have money to do that, and we didn't have many people saving here. So I had to like look at almost every corner of this animal called museum. I visited the conservation center and different ones, like working with stone, organic material like leather and other things, and you know, modern stuff. Just looking at how people would restore museum pieces and what goes into that and how it's all done. And then I'll go and sit with the people planning and designing exhibitions. So I did almost everything that needs to be done at the museum. A few years ago, I would remember that and still, you know, act like that. But after this many years now, I think I'm also like growing a little lazy and trying to like look at focus and concentrate on one area. Yeah. Maybe it's because of age or what, but there was a time when I didn't mind that, and I would. And yeah, that was a bit of me too, always trying to like, you know, learn whatever comes my way, and like a sponge or a healthy brain, find a way of absorbing whatever comes. If you can't take it anymore, you'll spit what you can't digest. And also I visited areas of performing arts. Like I spent some time at a theater school, learning how you turn people into actors. Mm-hmm. I spent some time at a visual arts center where they were doing different graphics and formal drawing. And that thing is going to bang.
Ma is coming.
Okay. There's, what do they call it? Croaky, where some individual will strip and stand in front of artists, and they stand there with their little with their little drawing books, and because I was I wanted to like see which subject where when you're teaching art would be the one that will put some craziness in the mind of artists, because artists, especially visual artists, are said to be a little special. I want to see how they teach them to be a little crazy, and I discover that they strip people and ask the artists to draw them. And we did that, and like standing and laying on the bed, and it was mostly women. I don't remember working with a male model. And then I was a theater school, this art, and also spent some time working with people who were doing what was known as children's theater. I was used to like storytelling, but this was something different, where you try to bring in much of theater, as much of theater as you can, like even if you are using props, animating them properly, and trying to like take away the attention from you as a person and draw them into what you are animating, and which was not easy. But luckily, I had worked with tried my hand at the puppeteria before, so it helped. And I enjoyed that. I really loved working with young people. And for some reason, Danish kids liked me. I remember there was a time when this teacher was having a problem, because kids, they are not allowed to discipline their kids. They were like all over the place and shouting. So she went out and called me, "Please, Kobi, can you come and work your African magic and get these kids to come down?" So I called them and, you know, told them a story and tried to convince them how important it was to like channel our energies one direction, because if you scatter, it's not going to work. Very, very soon we'll all be tired. They're going to get tired of running up and down. We're going to get tired of shouting at them, saying, "No, stop, don't run around, don't shout, don't." We're all going to be tired and we're not going to have a good show. And what is it that we're all looking forward to? We agreed that it was a good show. And I said, if it's a good show that we all want, let us all channel our energy towards that. And it worked. They listened and they responded. And this, because they are not allowed to beat the kids or what. So the best thing they can do when kids don't understand, to show them that they are serious, is to shout. And once we shout, the little guys will put the defense and they'll make you shout more. And you'll be like the crazy one at the end. So yeah, it worked fine, and they kids are amazing. And after some weeks, because I was stuck in that area for some time, I'll run into them, you know, like I'll be in a bus, walking or getting into a bus, and I hear this tiny voice calling my name, "Oh, Scooby, Scooby!" Now, when I look and find that the mother is trying to cover the mouth, because parents are always embarrassed. "How do you know this man?" "Oh, it's Scooby, he's my friend, he came to our school." And of course, I'll go over and, you know, talk to them. And
do you work with children here in the museum?
Not a lot, but I used to do that. And I'm going to try to find a way of doing that too. You know, continue working with young people. At some stage, this was like my, now I'm sharing with you my secret. Like, it's good to get them early before they are corrupted and taught all these negatives and wrong languages. You teach them the right thing so that when the time comes, people try to corrupt them, they know what to, how to think, how to, you know, thought process and all that. Because mostly we just give this to kids, and at times we even like influence their thoughts. Instead of teaching them how to use them, how to think, we teach them what to think, which is wrong. Now it's like the thought is complete for them, and this is what we are doing to kids. And next thing we're saying they are dumb. Next thing we're like, they are forever doing this. Because we fail them anyway in terms of preparing them. So that's why I was like, it's for some selfish personal reason. But I think if we do a lot of that, then we'll have a more comfortable world. And we don't have to like worry about kids doing strange things, because they know what is expected of them and what is Yeah.
So when did you become a curator officially?
Yeah, interesting. I said, I was the old man at the beginning, and then I did this Danish tour, and then came back. Then it was all men and a museum educationist. They have that term in Denmark, museums pedagogue, museum teacher. And I did that. And somewhere in 1990, was it 92 or 94? But it was in the early 90s. The University of Botswana started offering a course on museology, certificate course. I attended this for like one academic year. And then when I came back, I think I ceased from like being all men throughout. I became more and more on education and, you know, collection and assisting in that area. And then somebody was recruited to localize the curator's post, because now we were like the second Danish curator, and he extended for a year. And I was like, no, we can't support you forever, and train, find a way of, you know, a permanent replacement. So this guy was recruited. He was a trained secondary school teacher. He had a history background, studied at the University of Botswana. He came here, worked for a year and a half or something, and he was sent to England. I think it was Leeds, where they teach Leicester Museum Studies. And he got his master's and came back. And the expectation was that he was going to do a great job for us here. He was here for a short while, and then there was like problems with the, now I've gotten my master's, I'm not paid enough, there was this, there was that, and he left. He was not happy. He left the museum. And then we had no curator and nowhere to look to. So my poor board ended up appointing me, even though they had agreed that I didn't have like I didn't qualify, I don't have the, you know, background and all that. They appointed me curator, and they did this with full knowledge. So I told them, like, okay, you are giving me this post, appointing me like this, and you can see all of you around the table have said that I'm not dressed up for that, you know. Metaphorically, you can say I'm all tattered, but you are giving me this post. And then the mission should be to ensure that I get dressed up, you know, get the right suits to do this post. And that was the agreement, which never happened. I never got any further training after that. And then at times when things got a little difficult, they would blame my background and thing. And it's like, hey, you did this with full knowledge. I'm not going to allow you to do this. It came up once and I told them, I'm not going to listen to this next time it comes, because we all knew, and I said it to you, that we all know where we are, and you did this, and next thing you didn't do what you promised, because the promise was that I'll be given some training while I'm, you know, still serving here. And then, yeah, of course, and somewhere along the line, you know, you learn as you go, and that's many, many years ago. I can't even remember what year that was when I was appointed curator, and I kept the doors to the museum open, and then somewhere along the line we were, I don't know if it was through Winani again or somebody else, we were introduced to this Swedish organization that was trying to bring together museums in Africa and Sweden, you know, twinship programming and all that. It was called SAMP for short, Swedish Africa Museum Program. I think it was also busy in thing, engaged in Zambia, because that's how I got to know about the Mota Mota and the other places. And, you know, because we at some stage thought that it would be, since we couldn't do it for us within the continent, couldn't we get some to help us twin or have some twinship programming within, you know, African museums to African, you know, within the continent. And of course, they were not keen on that. They wanted to involve me. Of course, they were paying and they had to get something. They were not like really focusing on developing the continent on its own. They had to get something out of it. So that's never worked. But there was a time when we would be like one or two African museums and one Swedish museum. So that also like helped us to get to know more about what is happening in neighboring countries. Because that's important. If you are developing, your neighbor would be the one to check and, you know, learn from and ask questions like, how do you manage this? And looking at the history of museums in Botswana, we have a unique one in that we didn't inherit any museum from our colonial protectors or developers or whatever you want to call them. So with the SEMP, now we've got, I traveled to some other parts of Scandinavia, now Sweden, learn a bit more about Sweden. And then some years later, SEMP gave birth to a baby called Alas. Alas now was a bit ambitious. We're looking at Africa, L, that was Latin America, Sweden, and Asia. So now we had, that was really, really interesting. This is how I got to see a bit of South America and those crazy corners like the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, Costa Rica, And then Asia, starting with Madagascar, India, that country which was part of old Soviet, Azerbaijan. So, and looking at museums there, and you know, and then, of course, we did a bit of Africa, like South Africa, Robben Island. I remember we had one session there at, in Cape Town, and then we visited Robben Island, and And then there were other organizations that kind of brought the or helped me see what was happening in the like museum world at large. There was a time when we had a course in Mutare, Zimbabwe, which was called, it was focused on African museums. It was all about preparing and trying to like add life to a museum, because people say our institutions are dead. So it was called Museum Enlivening, run by a British gentleman called Malcolm Thomas. And so there we learned again a bit on how to add life to our institutions. How can we be more appealing, interesting, and exciting? So we learned different things. I remember when we were doing this exercise, somebody was like, imagine how many people would come to our institution if somebody went and said that Monica Lewinsky's blue dress was exhibited at such and such a museum. This will draw people. Now we started like going outside the museum traditions to try and look at other things that we can do at our institutions to draw more people, to be more appealing. Because first, what we did was to look at all these publics, or the general public that we're supposed to serve. What kind of people? You find scholars, you find people who come because they are bored, you find some who come to look at something they can steal. It's a whole, you know, variety. And how do you appear to be alive to such a varied thing? And so we explored all different ways of, you know.
Have you been able to apply the things you learned here?
Yeah, to some extent. I did a bit of that. I remember coming back because I was really fired up. This is when we could still have meetings with other regional museums in Botswana. We had a tiny body that we called Botswana Museums Association. I remember carrying out the exercise with the other colleagues, and the agreement was that, okay, since we will be holding meetings at different museums and touring the country like that, each time we are at a museum, we'll do such an exercise, see what is it they are doing now and what they, you know, how can they improve on it. And then, you know, so it nearly caught on. But then we didn't have enough money to keep on having our meetings and all that. I don't know if I've told you that the funds we get from central government are like enough to pay staff salaries. And it's really a difficult one. I'm getting money to be, you know, paid to do what? Because I'm not given money to do what I'm expected to do. This is why at times I have to like get money out of my pocket so that I can pay for things to happen. Then I can appear to be, yeah, some to get things done. It's not an easy one.
So how are you funded? Just explain that. The funding comes from central.
Yeah, from the
National Museum.
Yeah. The, well, when we started, at least it would give a slightly different picture because we would sit down and make a, what is it called, estimate budget, you know, figure by figure, everything that had to be paid for and that we, you know, had to cover. And then this would be sent to the National Museum with the hope that they will pass it to the people who are doing the government budget. Or if not that, at least tell them, looking at what we are asking for. But then this exercise became kind of hopeless in that no matter what you have written, people never looked at that. They'll just give you what they think or feel you qualify for. I never got to know the criteria they were using, and so now we just wait for whatever figure they give us. And some 5 years ago, we met the then Minister of Wildlife and Parks and, you know, museums fall under those rules. It's wrongly placed. We went and saw him, and the first thing he said to us was that, I have realized and noticed that at regional museums, it's only passion that operates because the money that government is giving you hasn't changed in 15 years. So it means you guys haven't had a salaries increase for the last 15 years. And to me, I think it's only your love for the work you are doing that is keeping you there. Because otherwise, we'd have tried to like find a better place where people would, you know, give you increment accordingly. So that's how the funds. But it's not completely bleak. Like towards the end of last year, we were told that there will be this, I don't want to call it cash injection because it's now coming. But we were told that it was going to be something like that. The promise was that we will get a cash injection and we would even be allowed to have a period where we can like put this money into some interest earning account, so that we can, you know, earn some interest before we go and carry out the project, because it was meant to help us develop and, you know, grow our capacity. But now, when the time got closer, suddenly we saw people who are like, what do you call them, tenderpreneurs, man. People who come here like, yeah, we nannies kind of guys, you know, the consultants. They came here and asked questions and they were like, these are the people who are not preparing themselves to like be the ones to guide us on how to spend this money. And now it appears like we're not even going to get the money into our accounts. It will be just paid per need. We complete the project and then they pay.
So you have to do the project before you get the money.
That's how government works.
So what?
Or it will be like you go and get, or something gets done, make an invoice, send it over, and then they pay them. The business people know that government works like that, so they'll be willing at times to supply before they even get the money, as long as they know it's government.
What's the scheme called?
I don't know what they're going to call it.
Yeah.
But it was with the National Development, where are we, 10 now, or 11, I think it's NDP 11 or something.
NDP 11.
Yeah. National Development. Whatever. Number 11. So yeah, again, one is used to this, and I can't start kicking or, you know, and rising hell. We just have to like wait and see how this thing is going to work out and make the best of it. And that's it. 60. And so I don't. We don't even know when it's going to happen. But we'll wait and see. And if you you've been in a situation where you have nothing, and if you get a tiny little thing, you make it. You know, you make it sound like it's the best thing that ever happened to you. So, and of course, it does that. You start saying it's so tiny, I can't even work with this, it to be exactly that. So I've learned those tricks here, and things always work out. And and we have had like dreams to, when you asked me about working with kids, or children, we at some stage had, when we bought a Macintosh property, that's the building next to, or the property, we built the white one. There was a colonial style house there. The idea was to have a youth center where young people can be trained on different areas. And we had identified things that will interest them, but we're also going to add on other important, like life skills, man. Like how do people manage their affairs and look? How do you take care? How do you become a complete chief executive officer of your life? Yeah. Because you need that. You've got, you know, as a human being, you might have some spiritual needs and need someone who might assist you with spiritual upliftment, a pastor or whatever. But you should be in a position of picking the best one, not the guy who'll be going for your money or looking at the kind of car you're driving or, you know, such. So, and we expect him because there is a thing called Department of Youth and Culture. Yeah, that's what they call them. Now it's a whole ministry. It's youth, sports, and culture. I think culture comes last, and this is why they think of us last. I thought with such a department, it would be easy to get support. So I told them we have this thing going. The guy who was in charge in Sorua, he was very, very helpful. Like we managed to get some support from them. Like we bought stuff for the kids. But when the time came now for the whole thing to operate and run, nobody was willing to support us. And I was like looking at what I have to do again here at the museum and also on the other side. And I was like, there's not much I can do. So, but we'll find a way of using that and, you know, cutting corners and seeing how to use it a little.
You need to go and collect Junior.
Yeah, I think so.
I have more questions, but I think we'll have to stop now.